Hey guys, Jack Wilkie here, starting something new. This is the first edition of a video mailbag. I'm going to take comments, questions, messages I received and respond to them from time to time. I'm really trying to get more into video content, and so subscribe to my YouTube channel here. This is also going up on my site, jackwilkie.co, and the podcast feed. You can listen by audio. There will be scripture graphics and all that are helpful, and so I recommend the video most. Again, you can find it on my site or on my YouTube channel. Again, it's something I'm trying to start doing. I'll be doing more here and on the Focus Press channel as well to try and add to the articles and podcasts and books and other content we're already putting out. With this one in particular, though, this is going to be in response to my article, The Case for Closed Communion. Came out a couple of weeks ago and got a lot of messages, a lot of comments, a lot of positive feedback, a lot of negative feedback, a lot of skepticism and questions about how is this all going to work. And so I want to get into that and really discuss some of the ideas, questions that came up out of this whole thing. And the first of those, just briefly to recap, if you did not get to read the article before I bring up some of the quotes and scriptures and all that, there are three levels of communion. One is open. It's an invitation, or it's just kind of, we're not going to check, just pass the communion. If you take it, you take it. If you don't, you don't. It's on you. There's this kind of more recent idea, I guess, or idea that's gaining popularity in some circles of serving it to visitors and telling visitors and children and everybody to partake as a way of showing them they are welcome in Christ, which I am strongly against if you read the original article. And then third, closed or close communion. I'm going to tie them together here. Just the idea of, really, it's only for Christians. And in some way or another, which we'll talk about towards the end, telling people not to take if they're not a baptized Christian part of the church. And so with that in mind, let's get into some of the questions that have come up. I started off by saying that it was for members in good standing. A lot of people said, well, what is that? Every week, is there a checkup? Is there some kind of thing where you've got to prove that you're faithful before you take? No, it's a person who's a baptized Christian, until the church knows otherwise, is considered a member in good standing. You just think of Acts 2. The Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved in Acts 2:47. You're added to the church. You're now part of those breaking bread and partaking of the Lord's Supper together and gathering in that way. Until you're not. And so, and we'll get to the how you're not later on, but it's pretty simple. Don't overthink that part of it. But then the question that kind of underlines all of this is, what happens at the Lord's Supper? Is it just crackers and juice? Is it crackers and juice unless you want it to be something more? And then it's a memorial of Christ? Is that how this works? So to draw on a few scriptures in 1 Corinthians 5, which we'll come back to again later, he calls Jesus our Passover in 5 verse 6, says he was sacrificed for us and that we're keeping this feast. And so there's a lot of, he's not directly talking about Lord's Supper, but you put all the pieces together and you can see that he is, that the Lord's Supper is the Christian Passover. It's the reminder of passing over out of sin, out of slavery to sin, just as they were leaving Egypt and the blood applied to the door and the blood applied to Christians. And so you're starting to get a sense of who it's for, is those that had the blood applied. The same way in the Passover was not for everybody. We see in 1 Corinthians 11, probably the most well-known Lord's Supper text, where Paul, quoting Jesus, says that this is my body which is broken for you. Comes back around, this do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. That's not an individual you, as I grew up saying it's you guys, or as I live in Tennessee now, the people around here would say y'all. This is for y'all. It was done for y'all. Y'all are going to do it. You group of people. Well, who is that? Christians. Paul's writing to Christians. And so the Lord's Supper is this memorial feast for Christians in which we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Again, parallels to Israel in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 and 4, said they all ate the same spiritual food, the manna that came down from heaven, which Jesus told us was himself in John 6, all drank the same spiritual drink from the spiritual rock that was Christ, he continues on there in 10:4. So partaking of Christ, drinking of Christ, very similar, what their spiritual food and drink, our spiritual food and drink. It was just for Israel, this is just for the church. And then, of course, continuing on in chapter 10, where he's talking about the fellowship nature of the Lord's Supper, and the fellowship with the idols, and sitting down eating meat sacrificed to idols, where he says in 1 Corinthians 10:16, "The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? For we, though many, are one bread and one body, for we all partake of that one bread." Again, that we, that's Christians, that's us. And taking the Lord's Supper is our communion in the blood of Christ. It's what brings us together. And so he says, "Observe Israel after the flesh. Are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar?" Again, there's exclusivity in all of these things. And so what is the Lord's Supper? What really happens there? It's an act that is not just between you and God, but binding us together. But the question comes up, well, what's the harm in it? Somebody who's not saved takes of the Lord's Supper. What difference does it make? They're not any less saved. And so the question from that shifts to, there is harm in giving them something that, there is harm in telling them they're not allowed to take it. Well, they might be embarrassed. They might not want to come back. And so there's way more harm in telling people not to take it than there is in just letting them have at it. I disagree. I think a message is sent by the things that we do. And so there's four directions we have to consider here. First, what does it say to God when we just say, hey, this is this sacrifice, this meal that Jesus set aside for us of his body and blood, and anybody can take it. It's just for everybody. I know Paul just said you and we, and this is our communal meal and all of these things, but anybody can have these things. No, it says something to God. I quoted in the original article from the Didache, which is a first century text. I mean, apostles were alive, at least John was alive, likely, at the time this document was written, about the practice of the early church. And Didache means the teaching of the 12, something was recorded and written down. And they say, "But let none eat or drink of your Eucharist except those who have been baptized in the Lord's name. For concerning this also did the Lord say, give not that which is holy to the dogs." That application there, Everett Ferguson goes on about that to say, "The application of Matthew 7:6 may be surprising, but it is not so far-fetched as one might assume. The elements, because of the use to which they were consecrated, were counted as holy things. Dogs in Jewish usage referred to non-Jews, Mark 7:27, and would have been taken over by Jewish Christians in reference to those outside the redeemed community of spiritual Israel. The emphasis on the church and Christianity as a community religion is notable in this document." These are holy things, and it's not just to throw haphazardly anyone anywhere. It says something to God when we treat it that way. That's where he talks about in 1 Corinthians 11, taking in an unworthy manner. It's the body and the blood of the Lord. You don't want to be guilty of that, and it brings judgment to yourself. And so is there harm in the person taking it? Yes. It's judgment that comes upon themselves by taking in an unworthy manner. That really matters. Again, about the impact to God, in Leviticus 10, where he struck down Nadab and Abihu, he told Moses, "By those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified." Think about what it tells God when we're not treating him as holy in this holiest central act of the church, the Lord's Supper. Think about what it tells that partaker that, yeah, no, this is just anybody, go for it. It's not a big deal. Think about what it tells the rest of the church that, hey, this is not really a holy separate thing, unless you want it to be, unless it's individually in your own head you're going to make it that way. And think about what it tells all of the lost, that they can come in and out and take or not take, or it's just up to you. God's not being treated as holy is one of the main points I want to make in all this. And the question I ask, and I ask it again, is the Lord's Supper a right? Or is it a privilege? We're treating it like a right. Nobody can tell me that I can't take it. Nobody can tell anyone that they can't take it. Or is it a privilege that was paid for with the utmost cost of Jesus' blood, and it needs to be treated like a privilege? And privileges have a little bit of gatekeeping involved, which we'll get to here in just a minute. So yes, it says something to God. There is harm in giving it to somebody. Carrying on once again in 1 Corinthians 10, where he says, this is the communion of the blood of Christ. What does it tell the church itself? What does it tell the other Christians? Yeah, this was a thing specific for us, but it really anybody can have it. You just broke communion. You broke fellowship. You broke what comes out of all of those things. But one of the objections I got was, this is a very private matter. It's not anybody's business to say that somebody should or shouldn't take it. This is just between you and God. It doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. You see that word communion there in 1 Corinthians 10:17. I've got if you're looking at the video, the Greek reference, koinonia is the word, which means fellowship, participation, sharing. It's something you do together. It's literally something you can't do on your own. And so when I had comments saying communion is a very personal, private act, that's an oxymoron by definition. Communion, community, communal, union, community. I mean, like, it's people coming together. And so, no, it's not a private act. It's not just your business between you and God. Carrying on from that, some would say, well, what about secret sin? There's going to be somebody in the pews who's not right before God, so in that way, they're not a member in good standing. So if you're, how far are we going in judging? Are we reading people's minds? That's where 1 Corinthians 11:28 comes in. People say it was a private act because you're supposed to examine yourself. No, the church can see the external. If there's an adulterer, if there's, you know, an unrepentant bank robber in your church, you can say, no, you're not right with God. You're not part of this communion, community. You're not with us before Christ, so we're not serving it to you. You can't know about the person who's got a porn addiction that they're not repenting of and not fighting and not addressing. You can't know that. That's for that person to examine themselves and examine their relationship with their fellow man, which is the direct context here of 1 Corinthians 11. So, no, we can't know secret sin. That is on each person and their walk with God. But as for the external, we're absolutely supposed to do that. This is the next question it raises. Does the church have this authority? So many people said, no, nobody has the right to do this. Nobody has the right to tell anybody anything about their walk with God. I'm just going to go through these real quick because it's blatantly obvious that actually, yes, this is part of the church's job. I mean, you think about the idea of a shepherd, an elder, that shepherds build fences. Shepherds guard their sheep. Shepherds keep outsiders out, keep the inside in and protect them. And this is all what's going on here when there's sin in the camp. So does the church have this authority? 1 Corinthians 5, I already brought it up, but the man who had his father's wife. Paul, just look at these phrases I have highlighted. That he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you. Paul says, I've already judged him. He says, you're supposed to deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, that he might be saved. He talks about purging out the old leaven and goes on to say, remove the wicked man from among yourself. Don't keep company with him. Don't even eat with such a one, because that person's not among us. He's not one of us anymore. And that not even eat, in context with Christ the Passover, heavily implies starts with the Lord's Supper, not eating with them. In Matthew 18, of course, maybe the prime church discipline text, Jesus ends up saying, let that man be to you like a heathen and a tax collector, essentially an untouchable. 2 Thessalonians 3:14, Paul says, note that person, do not keep company with him, that he may be ashamed. And then, I believe this is in Titus, reject the device of man after the first and second admonition. Get rid of them. Push them out. Don't let them partake in the... And some people, I guess, did want to make this claim. It says, don't even eat with such a one. Let him be like a heathen and a tax collector. Don't keep company with them. All of these things that say, cut this person off. People would say, well, accept the Lord's Supper. That's... We can have fellowship with them there. No, that would be... That's the foundation of our fellowship. That is the center of our fellowship. So if you can have fellowship with them there, you can have fellowship with them anywhere. Anything goes. And so, no, it is absolutely given to the church to do this. And people say, well, God wouldn't do that. Well, the meal that this was based on, and it's not a one-for-one parallel, but the idea is certainly there, is the Passover. From Exodus 12, God said, no foreigner shall eat it. Sojourner, hired servant shouldn't eat it. A stranger, if he wants to, he can. He's got to become circumcised and become as a native of the land. He has to convert. He doesn't get to have the Passover unless he converts. There's a principle in that that very much applies to our discussion of who's supposed to take the Lord's Supper. Which leaves us the question, can the church definitively say if someone is a Christian or not? This individualism that kind of rots our brain that has come to us philosophically over the last few hundred years that says, it's nobody's business but your own. Essentially, you have your own truth. It's no good. We can't operate that way. We can say a person who's been baptized into Christ, and again, is as far as anyone can see externally, and we assume internally, is walking with God, they're an active member of the church, they're in attendance and all those things, that's a Christian. If we can't say what a Christian is, or if we can't say what a Christian is not, we can't say what a Christian is. This is where this church discipline issue comes in of, no, you're no longer a Christian. Hebrews 10:26, you're trampling underfoot the body and blood of Christ. We're not going to keep serving it to you and saying, here, eat and drink judgment to yourself. Having established now that the church does have the authority to tell backsliding, wayward members, you're not welcome at the Lord's table, it follows pretty naturally to say, yeah, no, also outsiders, non-Christians, can't take. Because if you're saying, well, you're not a Christian anymore, so you can't take, but this non-Christian, they're allowed to take because they didn't come in and then backslide, they're okay, but you're not. The point, the principle under all this is Christians get the body and blood of Christ. That's who it's for. It's not for anybody else. And so that's the issue that comes up. The question I got a few times is, how would it work? Again, it's been done for 2,000 years in various places. It's not as popular now, but it's, if you want to, it's not that hard. I'll link an article by Brother Jeremy Marshall, who found in Chrysostom the reference to closing the doors. They would ask, or not really ask, they would tell non-Christians, get out, we're closing the doors. This part isn't for you. You can listen to the sermon, you can be here for the song service. This isn't for you. We're closing the doors, you're going to step out. You wouldn't even have to go that extreme. Alexander Campbell in The Christian System described a worship service where the Christians sat closest to the table, the non-Christians, the outsiders, sat further back in the auditorium, and it said that they distributed the Lord's Supper until every disciple had eaten, and that was it. They moved on. And so they seated by people who were partaking and people who weren't partaking. You don't even have to be that extreme. I mean, you could start small by saying, this is for Christians. This is not for everybody. This is for those to whom have received the body and blood of Christ through baptism and are members of the Lord's church. So that leaves one final question. Why talk about this? I've said, and I said in the article, I don't think this is going to get widespread adoption anytime soon. This is not something where a lot of churches read the article and they're going to run out and start practicing it. The point is to think about what the church is, to think about what we're treating the church as, and really 2 points I want to key in on here. First, church authority versus individualism. All of this is individualism, to say you can't tell me anything, you can't put up a fence, elders have no right to any of this stuff, church discipline is basically a suggestion that you're really not part of this anymore, but if you want to just keep coming in and taking it, we can't stop you. Yes, we can. Church authority is there. Now it can become overreaching and all that. We're so far from that in this day and age because we're so deferent to the individual and their desires. We need to get back a little bit in the other direction towards elders building fences, which shepherds are supposed to do, and allowing them to do so. And amening when they do this and tell somebody, you know what, you're in sin, you're not repentant, we've gone to you, we've tried, you're not welcome at the table. And also to the outsider to say, this isn't for you, we want you to want this. If we just, you know, that question again, is there any harm in it? If we're telling somebody, yeah, your individualism is the most important thing, that you don't feel excluded, that you feel welcome. No, the most important thing is that they recognize the holiness of God. They recognize there's something beautiful and valuable here that they don't have, and it's a motivation to get it by obedience, by confession, by faith in Christ and baptism and everything that is prescribed. That's what we should be aiming for. Rather than coddling the individual, we should be pointing towards, hey, there's something bigger than you here that you have to submit to. The second part of it is church purity. Everything in today's day and age is, well, what are people going to think? And how do we keep as many people comfortable as possible? The best way to get numbers is by appealing to the most amount of people, and the way to appeal to the most amount of people is to have a really thin gospel. I'm done with it. We have to have a pure church. I've said before that everything you're seeing in the culture, the decline, the world falling apart around us is not persecution that's turning on the church. It's discipline. It's God looking at a people that should know better and saying, you're under discipline until you get your act right. Well, discipline starts with the house of God. It starts with ourselves saying, you know what, we're not going to tolerate people claiming to be Christians, but not actually being Christians. We're not going to allow somebody to come in our doors and say, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, and I show up once every 4 months and just take the Lord's Supper as always. No, the purity of the church needs to rise to the center of what we're trying to do, rather than just, man, let's pass this out to as many people as we can and really hope they like us. That's not what we're called to do. And so one final question, is Christ's body and blood for everyone, or is it for anyone? And that's very similar to the question of, is it a right or is it a privilege? It's not for everyone. It's for anyone who comes to him, anyone who repents and follows the steps he's given to become a child of his and to submit their lives to him and die to self and everything that happens in our conversion, anybody can have that. Not everybody gets the benefits. Not everybody gets the blessings of the family. primary in that is the Lord's Supper, is the confirmation of our salvation and the fellowship together and the uniqueness and the separation from the world that happens in that weekly moment of the body and blood of Christ. That's not for everyone. It's for anyone who wants it. We're not, you know, pushing people away. We're telling people God made these boundaries around this, and we're going to expect you to meet it. And so that's a brief rundown, as brief as I can get it. As I said, if you haven't read the article, the original, go check it out. You have the site there on the screen, jackwilkie.co. You can subscribe there, get all the latest articles by email. Subscribe to this YouTube channel so you'll get the latest videos. As I said, I'll be doing more and more of this, Lord willing, over the weeks and months to come, and responding in this way. Sometimes it's just easier to lay it out this way. And so if you have other questions, comments, if there's arguments in here or verses that I missed or you want to bring up or discuss more, you can leave it in the comments on the site. This article will be going out as an email, or this video will be going out as an email, and will be on the site where you can comment, or on YouTube, wherever you're catching this. And I will talk to you guys next time.